We'll hear arguments first this morning in number 76938, Federal Maritime Commission and others against the Pacific Maritime Association. Mr. Friedman, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may I please... Court. Section 15 of the Shipping Act requires persons covered by the Act to file with the Federal Maritime Commission a category, seven different categories of agreements, one of which is every agreement controlling, regulating, preventing, or destroying competition. Now, the Commission is instructed by the statute to disapprove agreements that fail to meet certain statutory criteria and to approve all others. It is illegal to carry out either an agreement that the Commission has not approved subject to the Act or one that has been disapproved. And any agreement approved by the Commission thereby obtains antitrust immunity. There are two questions in this case, which is here on a writ of certiorari to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. The first one is whether Section 15 covers any provisions of collective bargaining agreements. And the second is, if that question is answered affirmatively, whether the Federal Maritime Commission in this case properly denied to the particular provisions here involved a labor exemption, an exemption that the Commission has recognized as appropriate under Section 15 for collective bargaining agreements in certain circumstances. The respondent, the Pacific Maritime Association, is an employers' association comprised of most of the employers in the West Coast maritime industry, steamship companies, terminal operators, and stevedores. The Respondent International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union is the collective bargaining representative of the employees in that industry. And bargaining on the Pacific West Coast generally takes place on an area-wide basis. There are, however, a small number of employers operating on the West Coast who are not members of the Pacific maritime industry, including a number of ports on the Pacific West Coast that operate their own terminal facilities. Since 1935, PMA and its predecessors in the union have operated under a collective bargaining agreement that provided detailed arrangements governing the operation of the waterfront on the West Coast. The most important aspects of this is that together they have organized and control a joint registered workforce, a force which is registered and which is dispatched under union hiring halls that are jointly administered to particular employers on a job basis. The men are rotated. You don't have a particular crew working full-time for a particular employer. The men are rotated from job to job as the jobs come up. The PMA has a very elaborate system of central record keeping and payroll records. Everyone is paid centrally, even though they work for one employer 2 days and another employer 3 days of the week. And in addition, there's a very extensive jointly operated fringe benefit program under which they have a guaranteed annual wage, pension plans, welfare plans, vacation plans, and so on. And all members of PMA are required to contribute to the fund that sustains these fringe benefits. Now, prior to 1972, which was when the agreement involved in this case was negotiated, employers who were not members of PMA could obtain men from the registered workforce, union members, by negotiating directly with the local unions involved in their particular areas. And this happened frequently. Separate contracts were negotiated between many of the ports involved in this case and the local union. And in addition, the individual ports were able to negotiate for the fringe benefits provided under the master contract by a participation agreement that they negotiated with PMA and the union. And under this arrangement, the union permitted some of the non-member employers to use what they called steady gangs or steady men, that is, men who worked full-time for one employer rather than being rotated from individual to individual. PMA was of the view that the non-members' use of the registered workforce as it functioned put its members, the PMA members, under what they described as an obvious competitive disadvantage as against the non-members. And a major reason PMA's president indicated, page 90 of the record, was that under this arrangement, if PMA members were closed down as a result of a labor dispute, the members, the ports who were not members, could continue to operate because they were not bound by the arrangements, they were not members of PMA. And as a result of this, cargo and business was diverted from the members of PMA during these periods of labor disturbance to the non-members, which they thought was gave the non-members an unfair competitive advantage. They also believed that the use of the steady men gave them an advantage. And finally, they thought that it gave the non-members an advantage that they were not required to pay their full share of the fringe benefits in the same way that PMA members were. And after extensive bargaining in 1972, PMA and the union agreed upon something called the Non-Member Participation Agreement, an arrangement that was made a part of the collective bargaining agreement. And the provision provides that non-members must agree to be bound by the terms of the non-member participation agreement as a condition to using the registered workforce. Now, we've set forth in our brief a number of provisions, at pages 10 and 11 of our brief, a number of provisions of this non-member participation agreement that had an impact upon the non-members. But there are two of them that I'd like to stress at this argument, because those are the ones we think that probably have the greatest impact in terms of competition. The first thing was that the non-members must use the registered workforce upon the same terms as the members, which included drawing them, of course, from the union hiring halls, which they had been doing in the past, and a limited use of them in the case there were union work stoppages against PMA to the same extent that members of PMA were limited. And the non-member participation agreement stated the essence of this requirement was the acceptance by non-member participants of the principle that a work stoppage by ILWU against PMA members is a work stoppage against non-member participants. In other words, if there was a work stoppage against PMA, the non-members of PMA nevertheless would be bound not to use the workforce at the time the PMA members were barred from it. The second thing is that the non-members who wished to use the registered workforce had to participate in the fringe benefit plan on the same terms and conditions as PMA members. That is, they had to make the same payments to the fringe benefit program that PMA members would make. After the union and PMA agreed upon this non-member participation agreement, they endeavored to get the non-member ports to sign the agreement. And they pointed out to the non-member ports that unless they signed this agreement, they would not be able to use the registered workforce. And that is set forth at pages 65 and 77 of the appendix.
Mr. Friedman, you refer to non-member ports. And my understanding is that the PMA consists of steamship companies, terminal operators, stevedores, and so forth. When you say non-member ports, are there entire ports which have none of those who are members of the PMA?
There are some ports, as I understand it, where no one is a member. There are other ports where the port-operated facilities are not, but there are other facilities in the port that are operating by PMA. PMA, by the way, will accept anyone to membership who agrees to its terms. But I use this as kind of a shorthand. It's really all non-members of PMA who are engaged in any of these activities, but this particular case basically involves the ports.
And are they primarily publicly operated ports?
Or primarily, not? Yes.
You mean public bodies operate?
Yes, they're all public bodies, and the public bodies are required under the state statutes to do certain things and not do certain things. The response of the ports to the adoption of this non-member participation agreement and the endeavors by the union and PMA to get them to join it and sign up was two things. First, they filed a complaint with the Federal Maritime Commission, and secondly, they filed three antitrust cases. Two of those are still pending. The third has been dismissed. The complaint with the commission alleged that this non-member participation agreement...
Was the dismissal on the merits?
No, it was dismissed by the plaintiff.
Yes.
The record indicates they decided to dismiss it at some point. And I might add that the antitrust complaint that was dismissed challenged only one narrow aspect of this particular non-member participation agreement, something dealing with what they call stuffing and unstuffing of containers at the waterfront, and that has dropped out of the case because the National Labor Relations Board has held that that was an illegal hot cargo clause, so that's no longer in the case. They allege that the non-member participation agreement was an agreement that had to be filed under Section 15, that it was an illegal agreement under both Section 15 and also several other sections of the Act, and they urge the board to take jurisdiction of the case and to disapprove the agreement. I'm sorry, the commission, not the board. The commission severed for preliminary determination two questions in the case. One, whether Section 15 covered this agreement, and second, if it did, whether it was entitled to a labor exemption. Lengthy affidavits were filed in the case, and the basic point the ports made was that the registered workforce contains the skilled people necessary to operate these facilities, and that without the skilled people, they could not effectively operate their facilities. On the other hand, the ports pointed out that if they attempted to use non-union labor, if they could get it to do this work, the union undoubtedly would throw picket lines around and close down the ports. If, on the other hand, they signed up under this agreement, it would do two things, according to the ports. One, it would increase their expenses for a variety of reasons. And secondly, it would turn over control of their labor relations, which under their statutes they were obliged to handle, to third persons because they were bound, by doing this, they would bind themselves to all of the requirements of PMA. The commission held that it has jurisdiction under Section 15 over this agreement and that the agreement was not entitled to a labor exemption. The commission applied the standards it had developed in a case called Boston Shipping to determine the existence of a labor exemption.
Is there any statutory labor exemption in the Federal Maritime Act?
No, there is not, Mr. Justice, but the commission's theory is that since an antitrust exemption results when they approve an agreement under Section 15, and since competitive considerations are an important factor in the commission's administration of Section 15, it is appropriate to imply into the statute a labor exemption comparable to that this court has developed under the antitrust laws, and that's the basic theory upon which the commission operates.
Mr. Freeman, am I right? The commission hasn't yet either approved or disapproved of the agreement.
That is correct. All the commission has done is make the threshold determinations
that
the agreement
filed.
Has to be filed and that it's not entitled to a labor exemption. And indeed, after it makes those determinations, it issued another order setting the issues on the merits for hearing and determination. The commission said that this was an agreement which controlled or affected competition between the members and the non-members, and therefore was covered by Section 15, and accordingly was required to be filed unless a labor exemption existed. It found there was no labor exemption for two reasons under two of the criteria it had developed under Boston Shipping. First, it said this provision did not relate to a mandatory condition of mandatory subject of bargaining because it was directed not at the labor conditions of the members of PMA, but to the labor conditions of third persons, that is, the non-members, the ports. And in addition, the second related issue is that since it attempted to impose terms and conditions on people outside of the membership of PMA, it was attempting to impose those conditions beyond the bargaining unit. It concluded that this non-member participation agreement had a potentially severe and adverse effect upon competition, but only a minimal effect on the collective bargaining process. That's at page 70A of the appendix to the petition.
Mr. Freeman, when the commission asks whether the agreement is entitled to a labor exemption, even though it must be filed under Section 15, if they say that it does, is that just that it does have such an exemption? Is that just the equivalent of approving it?
No, that is not. That means.
But it does mean that the commission will not proceed to to deal with the antitrust considerations in the matter because they think that under our cases or under the court's cases, whatever effect on competition is covered by the labor exemption.
That is correct. This ruling of the commission granting a labor exemption would not be an approval of under Section 15 that would confer antitrust.
But it also keeps them from disapproving it.
Yes, it does.
Keeps them from disapproving it, although otherwise they might disapprove it on the grounds of its effect on competition.
That is correct. But, of course, in considering whether there is a labor exemption, they do carefully consider the impact on competition.
I understand.
But they wouldn't. This is the end of the case as far as the commission.
If they say that the agreement is not entitled to a labor exemption, then they're going to decide whether they would approve it or not.
That is correct.
And I take it from what you answered, Mr. Justice Stevens, that just saying that the agreement is not entitled to a labor exemption is not equivalent of disapproving it.
No.
So they could still approve it and thereby insulate it from antitrust.
Yes, they
attack.
Could. If we prevail in this case, so the commission will go ahead and it could approve it or could disapprove it.
And say that this is essential for the running of this steamship business.
Yes, they could. The only issue, I repeat, is that it's the threshold issue.
And if there's a finding contrary to this case that there is a labor exemption, then what follows? The commission...
That's the end of the proceeding.
Says you don't need to file it?
In effect, they would return it. That is,
but they don't approve it.
They don't approve it. I don't want to make that very...
But they must say then you don't... This because the labor exemption is applicable here, this is not an agreement that need be filed?
I would say that's the
is
effect.
Is that what follows?
That would be the effect of it.
Well, what is their order? Finding a labor exemption, then what does the commission do?
I couldn't tell you. I will hope to get the answer.
But in any event, they don't purport to approve it. And the agreement then is still open to attack in the courts as a violation of the antitrust
law. Oh, yes. They have not. There's no approval.
It's not approved, but it certainly hasn't been disapproved.
It hasn't been approved or disapproved.
Because there's a labor exemption, you don't need to file this for approval.
You have to preliminarily file it in order, I suppose, for them to know whether
certainly.
It has a labor.
Yes.
But the end result of giving it a labor exemption is as though it didn't have to be
but
filed
it,
at all.
But it effectively takes the antitrust issue out of the administrative process.
Oh yes, that's it's over because
and puts it back potentially in the courts
into the antitrust court, and I assume the antitrust court would not be bound,
yes.
of course, by the commission's determination.
Well, they don't purport to decide.
No.
Well, Mr. Friedman, isn't when you talk of labor exemption in this context, you're talking about exemption from the requirements of the Shipping Act rather than the antitrust law.
That means
if there's a labor exemption, as you're using the term. It means that the agreement need not have been filed pursuant to Section 15.
Exactly.
That must be the contract.
If they had so ruled.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what I'm suggesting is sometimes you may have to.
It may have been on file, sure,
to
but
determine
it,
whether you had to
right,
file.
Yeah.
Indeed, that's sometimes people will file an agreement requesting a ruling that it doesn't have to be filed to be sure that they're not subject to the Shipping Act.
But in determining whether or not there is a so-called labor exemption, the Commission draws not on Shipping Act cases, but on the decisions of the federal courts, including this court.
It draws upon those decisions, but it brings to bear its expertise on the shipping industry in balancing and weighing the competing impact on the one hand on collective bargaining and labor, and two on the other hand on competition.
But it draws on Allen Bradley in those cases.
In weighing the competing
which exonerated certain activities of labor unions from the antitrust laws.
Yes.
That's the body of law upon which the commission evidently draws.
Oh, yes. It states that exemption is drawn from those decisions. Its four criteria that it developed in Boston Shipping was stated to be its view of a distillation of the teachings of this court in the antitrust immunity cases. And indeed, in this very case, it said that it thought this particular agreement was very similar in its ultimate impact and its ultimate contours to the agreement this court held was not entitled to a labor exemption in the Pennington case, because it said in both cases it's a contract under which attempts are made to impose terms and conditions outside of the bargaining unit. Of course, in Pennington there was an attempt to drive the people out of business, which is not here, but it seems, and we fully agree, that the basic rationale of those decisions, of the decisions of this court, is that labor and management cannot get together and attempt to impose terms and conditions outside the bargaining unit on employers outside the bargaining unit.
They cannot because of the antitrust laws. Because they're subject to the antitrust laws, is what you mean.
Yes.
And the reason the commission draws on our labor cases, or the court labor cases, is because it is charged with considering antitrust considerations in approving agreements that have to be filed. And there is, in turn, an pro tanto exemption from the antitrust laws for certain types of labor agreements.
That is correct.
But it doesn't draw on our labor cases. It draws on our antitrust cases.
On your antitrust cases. Except to one extent, for example, where it has to consider whether something is a mandatory subject of bargaining, and if this court has interpreted that provision under the National Labor Relations Act, it would draw on those cases. But basically, what I would say is it draws upon the antitrust cases in determining the scope of the labor exemption, but then it implicates Shipping Act considerations when it decides whether or not the particular agreement is entitled to the labor
exemption. Are you, or is it necessary for you to defend the correctness and the wisdom and accuracy of the board's, of the commission's so-called distillation of these cases?
Well, I think it probably is, because our opponents challenge it, and our opponents say that the commission has improperly defined the labor exemption.
Well, do you think it's a little oversimplified, if not a little naive, if that's not too strong a word?
I don't think so, Mr. Justice, because that presents the general contours, I think their real criticism with us, perhaps, is more in the application of that test to the facts of this case than in the test itself. I don't think there's any quarrel between us that the commission properly can draw upon this court's decisions defining the scope of the antitrust labor exemption in determining the scope of the labor exemption under the
In any event, in this case, the commission found that there was no so-called labor exemption.
That's
And rightly or wrongly, that's what it found. Now, your brothers on the other side, their first position is that no collective bargaining agreement is subject to the Section 15's requirement of filing.
Isn't it? At all.
That's right. So that's whether or not there is a labor exemption within the board's criteria is really irrelevant to that basic argument, isn't it?
That's right. You only reach the question of the labor exemption if you agree that the board has jurisdiction over some agreements.
Yes.
And let me address myself to that question, because the Court of Appeals said that collective bargaining agreements are exempt as a class from the requirements of Section 15. Now, section in the Shipping Act, Congress provided an almost unique regulatory scheme. Agreements that would be illegal in any other industry under the antitrust laws may be permissible in the Shipping Act, provided that the government regulatory agency has examined these agreements, has evaluated them under the standards, and has determined it's overall in the public interest, taking account of all the competing and conflicting considerations, to approve them.
There's a very similar provision in the regulation of aviation in the CAB, isn't there?
I think tends to be narrower in the sense that I think it's there are for certain types of agreements, but I think the difference is that the pervasive character of concerted agreements and operations in the shipping industry. I mean, the statute was passed, as the court knows, against the background of the Alexander Report and the shipping conference system. And were it not for this legislation, a conference agreement, which everyone fixes prices and rates,
would be grossly violated.
Now, the one of the provisions on which the court applies, which the statute provides, is that agreements controlling, regulating, preventing, or destroying competition have to be filed with the commission. There's no question that some provisions in collective bargaining agreements would have that effect. In this case, the parties agreed to require things to be done by the non-member ports that would have that impact upon the ports. We think that there's nothing in the language or the legislative history of the whole scheme of the Shipping Act to indicate that Congress intended a blanket exemption of all collective bargaining agreements from the Shipping Act. What we think is that Congress intended the Commission in the first instance to take a look at anti-competitive agreements, even though they may have been the result of competitive bargaining, and that national labor policy is to be implicated not by saying that the Commission has no jurisdiction over any of these agreements, but through the application of the labor exemption that the Commission has determined. The labor exemption itself, in this case, was properly rejected by the Commission because, as the Commission stated, and this is at page 63A of the appendix, the agreement was specifically designed to compel non-member entities to join PMA under the threat of exclusion from the ILWU workforce. As such, it clearly imposes terms and conditions upon persons outside the bargaining group. And this court in Pennington recognized that there's nothing in national labor policy indicating that the union and the employers in one bargaining unit are free to bargain about the wages, hours, and working conditions of other bargaining units or to attempt to settle these matters for the entire industry. And that, we think, is precisely what this agreement was designed to do. PMA was putting into a collective bargaining agreement with the agreement with the concurrence of the union provisions designed to eliminate what PMA viewed as unfair competition by its competitive factors in the industry, by the non-member ports, and we don't think that the labor exemption can be invoked to justify that kind of an agreement. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Very well, Mr. Friedman. Mr. Fisher.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I'd first like to address myself to a couple of the questions asked by members of the Court. I think it will clarify a couple of matters if I do so. Mr. Justice Rehnquist asked whether PMA had any members who were ports. Mr. Justice Rehnquist's request to Mr. Friedman I'm responding to, PMA has no members who are public ports at the present time. There is an application pending by one port to join. But public port authorities generally do not employ stevedores. The non-member ports here are an exception. Excuse me, they do not perform stevedoring themselves, and therefore they do not employ longshoremen. So in the normal course, a public port is a landlord, as in the case of the Port of San Francisco or the Port of Los Angeles, and you don't find them having need to have labor relations with the ILWU, and you therefore don't find them becoming members of PMA or otherwise dealing with the ILWU. Mr. Justice White asked the question whether it might be the equivalent of approving the agreement if, in the event that the Commission determined the labor exemption applies. I'd say that's clearly not the case. The labor exemption goes to the Commission's jurisdiction over the agreement to act one way or the other. A determination, in fact, one of the problems with having the Commission in this particular act is that the determination that an agreement is labor exempt doesn't bind anybody for the future. Anyone who is not a party to that proceeding is free to turn around and file an antitrust complaint after the fact. So a determination by the Maritime Commission that you have a labor exemption doesn't really get you anywhere in terms of security, if you will wish to use that term, for the future.
Mr. Fisher, what happens as a consequence of a Commission determination that an agreement is exempt because of the labor exemption? Does it simply send the agreement back and say, because of this finding, it was not necessary to file this agreement for approval?
That's right. It's a jurisdictional determination. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, an industry group such as ourselves did not file our agreement with the Commission to ask them what they thought of it. As a practical matter, that's the last thing in the world you would want to do mm-hmm. if you felt that the Commission had no business meddling with it.
Right.
And in this case, the non-member ports brought the agreement to the attention of the commission. We ultimately filed the document because it had to be looked at under the circumstances
of the
case.
But only in response to
the Normally, you would sit it out and wait for someone to complain about it. Mm-hmm. And you would not go in and file the thing asking for a determination unless you felt it was such a marginal case
right.
that you had to do that to protect yourself.
But
normally, you would feel that if your agreement was a collective bargaining agreement, not subject to the commission's power to modify the substance of, to approve, disapprove, regulate after the fact, second guess you, you would vigorously resist that.
You would simply not file it.
You would not file it in the normal course. Mm-hmm. You'd take your chances.
And the commission finding that an agreement is within the labor exemption leads to a commission holding, at least implicit, if not explicit, this agreement need not have been filed.
Need not have been filed in the first place. That's correct, even if it had been physically
filed.
That's absolutely correct.
Do you argue, then, that the Labor Board has exclusive jurisdiction?
Oh, no. No, I think this Court has made that pretty clear. Jewel T., Connell, make pretty clear that the Labor Board's...
What you said sounded as though you... We're implying that only the Labor Board would have jurisdiction.
I think it would depend upon... No, I didn't mean to imply that if I did. I think it would depend upon the nature of the question. I mean, for example, the Solicitor General referred to a dispute over the container freight stuffing agreement. As the Court may be aware, this is a monumental subject of labor strife on both coasts, the issue of whether Teamsters or longshoremen stuff off-dock containers. It's been a subject of very critical recent concern and is involved in a tangential way or was involved in this case. That could very well have been a matter under the Commission's criteria that could have gotten the Maritime Commission into the Act. In that case, the non-member ports and more particularly cartage companies, other off-dock stuffers, chose to deal with the matter through a combination of the antitrust courts by filing a complaint and through the NLRB. It happened that that particular dispute, Mr. Chief Justice, was resolved by the NLRB. They said it was a hot cargo clause and knocked it out. One of the problems we have here is potentially if we have the Maritime Commission in this act, we have the NLRB, which proved itself capable of handling the container freight station stuffing disputes. We have the antitrust courts who have to resolve Pennington Jewel T type challenges. And now we would also have the Maritime Commission apparently under some kind of Shipping Act standards. And that's a very, very messy and undesirable way, I'd submit to you, to go about handling this dispute.
But basically, in any one of those forums, the way something starts out is by a plaintiff having standing, coming in and challenging. And the decision that the forum has to make, and if it's appealed, the courts on appeal have to make, is whether the Federal Maritime Commission or the NLRB or the courts had jurisdiction. And I suppose just the fact that more than one of them might have had jurisdiction to adjudicate a particular complaint, it is not inconsistent with the statutory scheme.
Well, I would submit to you that it is inconsistent with the statutory scheme. And one of the reasons, as a practical matter, why I think it's inconsistent is that in the case of Section 15, unlike the other statute you referred to, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, you have a pre-implementation approval requirement. And I said to the Chief Justice that in the normal course, if you wish to resist Maritime Commission jurisdiction, you would want to take the position it wasn't subject and you're not handing it over for filing in some kind of an approval. But as a practical matter, what if you have one that's fairly close to all fours, let's say, with one where the Maritime Commission asserted jurisdiction, as it did, for example, in the Boston case? Now, there, as a collective bargaining group, labor and management, you're in the position of having negotiated an agreement at the 11th hour, perhaps with a strike pending, and you're subject to a statute there where if the commission is at least asserting jurisdiction, you're facing possible penalties of $1,000 a day per member for failing to file the thing, even apart from whether it's approvable. Now, this isn't quite what you asked, but in my opinion, that is very seriously inconsistent with the policies, the labor policies. I think it's inconsistent with the way that antitrust courts get into this particular act.
Well, are you saying then that we must construe these various acts so that if one forum has jurisdiction, the other doesn't?
Oh, no. No, what I'm saying is that as between the NLRB and the courts, there may be a shared jurisdiction. That is to say, if it comes up, if the issue comes up in a Pennington context with an antitrust complaint, Jewell T. Connell make clear that the antitrust court is to resolve the labor questions inherent in resolving the labor exemption dispute.
Well, why can't you say equally consistently that the FMC and the courts have shared jurisdiction? If it's basically a maritime question, the FMC should resolve it.
Well, I suppose you can if this court says so. That's what we'll have to live with somehow. But I don't think it makes any sense.
If it doesn't make any sense, we shouldn't say it.
That's precisely my point. I don't think it does make sense. It doesn't make sense to have three cooks stirring this particular pot, and it's a difficult, difficult pot.
Did you say two cooks can stir it?
If I had my druthers, and I were arguing the Allen Bradley, or perhaps a better case, the Pennington case, I might have very well argued otherwise. It's too late to argue that. I think there are obvious difficulties with it. But there's one thing the court did make clear, and I find it very hard to argue with in Pennington, in Connell, in Allen Bradley, and that is that when you get to the point of a collision between two national policies, and by the way, this is frequently talked about as an antitrust exemption, or it's a labor exemption from the antitrust laws. That's a shorthand phrase, if I may so submit, for describing a larger jurisprudential process which involves the weighing of two statutory policies, national policies of equal weight. We call it a labor exemption. I've used the term in my briefs, too. It's not an exemption. It's a jurisprudential process of weighing conflicting statutory policies. And I can't quarrel with this Court's decisions. I think they are right when you say that when that happens, the proper forum to do that is a court. The worst forum of all is for an agency that has no jurisdiction over either the labor or the antitrust questions, which is what the FMC's claim is.
Why do you say it has no jurisdiction over antitrust questions?
Its jurisdiction under the Shipping Act, let's face reality, the job of the Maritime Commission and the reason for the Shipping Act is to grant antitrust exemptions for steamship rate-making conferences, which are otherwise per se violations of the antitrust laws. And its stock and trade is to review agreements that are on their face per se violations, no antitrust issues presented there other than the fact of the violation.
So it does have jurisdiction then with respect to antitrust issues.
Well,
you can't say it doesn't because it exempts. It's,
all right, in the sense, that's correct.
I can't
in the
imagine sense, anything that's a clearer piece of jurisdiction.
In the sense that the Maritime Commission grants an exemption, it has to take note of the fact of the antitrust violation in the first place. What I'm saying is it's a simplistic kind of an antitrust jurisdiction. The Commission doesn't administer the antitrust laws. It administers the Shipping Act, which is an exception from the antitrust laws.
Well, I would think you would be delighted if it took this agreement and exempted it.
Yes, one would suppose that. It must come as something of a surprise to the court to hear the industry group trying to explain to the court why we don't want to have this haven.
Why you don't want to
haven,
be exempted?
Why we don't want to have this haven. And
you're,
of course,
afraid, you're afraid the Commission may not do it in a simplistic way.
I guess what I'm afraid of is that the Commission will do it in a simplistic way. Let me just back up a second, Mr. Justice White. The problem here, I don't think, is what agreements the Commission will or will not approve.
No, in the larger sense. That
the problem is who makes the determination of whether a labor exemption applies or not.
Who should decide whether or not this agreement violates antitrust laws?
Exactly. I mean, let me give you some reality. We have a 200-page collective bargaining agreement with the union, industry-wide. I mean, let's not fool ourselves. Every section of this agreement affects competition in some fashion or another. You don't have industry-wide bargaining without having effects on competition.
Yeah, well, we've been through this many times.
That's right. But all I'm saying is that if the Commission is going to have jurisdiction over agreements which affect competition or which have some effect on outsiders, then we're talking about having the Commission, the agency which is least qualified to understand the labor implications of this agreement, passing on the labor exemption question. And I just don't think that's right or it makes any sense. No one is hurt by every other industry in this country.
Mr. Fisher, supposing a treble damage action had been filed against the industry on a Pennington theory,
yes,
in a federal court,
yes,
would it not have been an entirely proper defense for you to have asserted as a matter of primary jurisdiction the matter should have first been presented to the Maritime Commission? Wouldn't that have been a classic defense?
Oh, one might have, but I've been an antitrust...
Well, if it were a clearer antitrust question, say, I know not, you don't think Penica applies, but say the agreement had said we won't deal with companies that don't agree to the rates fixed by the conference or something like that. You would clear, and write in a collective bargaining agreement. Wouldn't that clearly be a case that you would, if you were sued in the antitrust court, you'd say that would go to the Federal Maritime Commission first?
I would say that would be a last desperation kind of defense. It might
last desperation? It's almost
this,
routine for, in this industry.
For this, not at all, Your Honor. If under the Carnation case, Carnation against Westbound Conference, this court ruled that when an agreement has not received the approval of the Maritime Commission, a treble damage action can be pursued in the antitrust court. It's not a matter of the commission's primary jurisdiction. I think it was a common sense kind of ruling. And so if the attack you're talking about has been mounted against a collective bargaining agreement that has not been submitted voluntarily to the commission and received the approval antitrust exemption rubber stamp, then there's nothing to submit to the commission. Carnation tells us that it's subject to the jurisdiction of the federal courts under the antitrust laws. It's too late. Now, if the agreement has been submitted to the Maritime Commission and given an approval stamp, that's the end of the line. But the other side of that coin is, let's assume the most egregious kind of agreement. Let's assume that PMA had agreed with the union to do some kind of Pennington Act, where we agree with the union, let's put somebody out of business, and he's a troublemaker, he's taking all our business. Let's put him out of business. Let's get rid of him. Right plain there in the collective bargaining agreement. Let's assume further we'd filed it with the Maritime Commission, we'd gotten the approval stamp, the antitrust exemption stamp. Now what happens to, perhaps on an interim basis, as the government suggests we do? I must say, I that might be very nice for some people in some instances, but it's a pretty hard thing for the fellow that's driven to the wall. He's denied his antitrust remedy. I don't think as a matter of policy that's what Congress intended in Section 15. Rate agreements,
so
yes.
The thing that's so puzzling is you seem to be most interested in vindicating the rights of those who want to disagree with you.
I'm not interested in vindicating their rights. What I'm saying is, a matter of policy, I don't think agreements, labor agreements of this kind, are the kind of thing that Congress wanted or that the industry really wants to be within the antitrust exemption. Congress didn't advert to labor agreements when they created the antitrust exemption. They created it for steamship rate conferences, not labor agreements.
Well, but, you know, you use terms in a very simple way, but agreements are complex things, and if they have anti-competitive consequences, you gave an example yourself. You say if you drove these ports out of business, there'd be a clear antitrust problem, but if you just double their costs, there's no antitrust problem.
Oh,
I'm not
at
sure
all.
The line is quite that bright.
There may very well be an antitrust problem. What I am saying...
You'd rather take your risks on having a jury decide it than the Maritime Commission.
I would rather take my risks having the federal court decide whether there is a labor exemption or not.
Well, what makes your suggestion is that the Maritime Commission may not really know what it's doing in this area, but you assume that some 500 federal judges are really experts in how the antitrust laws and the labor laws ought to be meshed in the maritime industry. That's a pretty good mouthful itself.
Well, I must tell you that we do not live in the choice between two perfect a perfect world, and we don't live in a choice between heaven and hell. We're making relative decisions.
It's just a choice between two evils.
But isn't it really a judicial function? And let's consider one other, Mr. Justice White. Your point reminds me of something that I think is important here. The Commission's argument to this court is that if it is the proper agency or forum, so to speak, to decide the labor exemption question, the consequence, they say, of that is that the Court of Appeal can only review the Commission's determinations for abuse of discretion. And since the labor exemption question is obviously a judgmental policy kind of point, what they're really telling you is that the Commission's decisions on this subject should not really be reviewable. It is something close to saying that the Commission's decisions are not properly reviewable except for abuse of discretion, whatever that is, in a court of appeal. Well, in the Allen Bradley case, this court, in reviewing a district court's decision, said it's up to us to make this decision. We must decide it here.
Your submission is that there's no part of any imaginable collective bargaining agreement that should ever have to be filed with the Commission.
That's absolutely right. And the reason that is the case is that you don't want the Federal Maritime Commission, which is not a judicial agency, it's a Shipping Act agency, deciding questions like whether the bargaining's in good faith whether it's a mandatory subject of bargaining, et cetera, as the courts inevitably have to do in every one of these labor antitrust cases, as subsidiary questions to the ultimate resolution. It's the wrong forum.
I know that's your submission.
Well, Mr. Fisher, is it conceivable that that there might be a collective bargaining agreement which involved a violation of the antitrust laws, just a patent violation of Pennington-type case, which would nevertheless be in the interest of industry, in the public interest for Shipping Act reasons? Is that conceivable? And therefore, there should be an exemption.
I think it's conceivable, but I guess what I have to say is to that is it's probably unlikely. And the main point is that Congress didn't consider that that was the kind of agreement that should be able to get an antitrust exemption.
Well, it surely did. Why, any violation of the antitrust laws can get exempt under Section 15.
Well, any antitrust violation that is subject to Section 15.
Sure, if it fits any of these definitions, regulating, preventing, or destroying competition and the like, which is almost another way of describing agreements and restraint of trade.
Well, I guess what I come down to is saying this. The standards of Section 15, taken loosely, can apply to almost any industry-wide collective bargaining provision that there is in the maritime industry that's subject to the Act. And if you're going, you just simply have to make a decision as to who's going to decide these questions. And if the commission is going to decide it, it might be nice for us to say, that we have a nice place to go to get an exemption. That would be handy at times, I suppose. But the fact of the matter is, the practical consequence is you've got the Maritime Commission in the backyard of your labor relations, second guessing you. They don't know anything about labor. They don't know anything about labor questions, and the disadvantage of that so vastly outweighs the what is supposed to be the safe haven from the antitrust laws granted by a Section 15 approval that we've made our choice the other way.
Very well, Mr. Fisher. Mr. Leonard.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I should like to focus on the questions which have been raised in the preceding arguments from the point of view of the labor organization involved, representing, as I do, the ILWU. It was my principal concern in coming here from the West Coast to assure the Court of the legitimacy of the union's interest in this non-member participation clause. Perhaps if I'd read the reply brief that the solicitor filed before I left San Francisco, I might have saved myself the trip. Because on page 6 of his brief, in addressing the question of whether the union has an interest in the integrity and work opportunities of the registered workforce and in the fringe benefits that the agreement covers, the solicitor says there's no question, and I'm quoting him now, that the union has such an interest. Indeed, he goes on to say that the union unilaterally could demand from non-members of PMA, whose employees it represents, the same terms as it undertook to require under this very agreement. It seems to me, point number one, with that concession by the solicitor, it's clear that what we have here is a labor contract with a legitimate trade union interest which bears on the question of whether or not there should be a labor exemption. The solicitor, however, goes on to argue that because, as he asserts, and as he asserted in his oral argument to this Court, the agreement allegedly imposes conditions on employees of members outside the bargaining unit, it therefore falls within the decisions of this Court in Connell and Pennington. The problem, however, is that this case, on its facts, is different from Pennell and Pennington. What we are talking about here is a workforce of employees who are all in one bargaining unit and who sometimes work for PMA and who very rarely and occasionally work for the non-members. The union represents all of them. It isn't as though the United Automobile Workers and the Ford Motor Company negotiated a contract to impose conditions on Chrysler's workers, for example. We have a single, solitary workforce on the West Coast who sometimes work for PMA.
Well, they aren't in the same unit, though. I mean, if you went to the labor board and to be certified, you wouldn't be certified. The unit certified wouldn't include these non-members.
Well, Mr. Justice White, that is precisely the question and precisely the reason why this is not a matter for Federal Maritime Commission jurisdiction. I don't know what the Labor Board would do in a case like this, and I don't know that the Labor Board has ever decided such a case, where you have a single unit of employees represented by the same.
Well, we have the United States here. The Solicitor General represents the United States, I suppose, and the Department of Justice is responsible for administering the antitrust laws. It represents other agencies of the United States. And I take it the United States' submission is that the antitrust issue, they're perfectly willing to have the antitrust issue and the labor issue decided in the first instance by the Maritime Commission.
Well, I understand that. That's the position of the United States. It was not the position of the Court of Appeals, and it's not
exactly
our position.
I understand that.
The question that you raise, I submit, Mr. Justice White, raises a very subtle, significant and important question of labor relations. Precisely what would the National Labor Relations Board do when confronted with a situation where there's a single employee bargaining unit, interchangeable employees, and, if you will, two separate employer bargaining units? Now, however that question is resolved on this issue, when the Solicitor General says it should be resolved a la Pennington and Connell, and I will point out in a moment why we think it shouldn't be resolved that way. But however it's resolved, it's our submission that it should be resolved by the agency that has the expertise to make that subtle decision in labor relations and not by the Federal Maritime Commission.
Well, doesn't the CAB do much that same thing with respect to airlines that the Federal Maritime Commission is here claiming a right to do with respect to shippers?
I don't have enough familiarity, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, with what the CAB does in labor relations to answer your question. My familiarity is essentially with the National Labor Relations Board, and since the beginning of this case,
with what the FMC has done,
so I'm just unable to answer that question.
How would this kind of issue come before the Labor Board? I can see how it kind of rise in a federal court in an antitrust treble damage action, but how does the Labor Board get involved in this? The kind of question is whether this collective bargaining agreement violates the antitrust laws or is anti-competitive or something like that.
The Labor Board doesn't get involved in the antitrust question per se. What it does get involved in is the question of the appropriateness of the bargaining unit. In this situation, as Mr. Fisher pointed out, in the container stuffing situation, the complaining parties, the ports, and so on, filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board to have the issue of the legality of that container stuffing agreement determined by the expertise of the labor agency.
But could the ports here have filed a charge with the Labor Board claiming that they were somehow hurt by this collective bargaining agreement?
Yes, of course they could.
Under what procedure?
I don't quite understand it.
It would be an unfair labor practice for the union and the employer to enter into a contract to compel the employers or the union to cease doing business with the ports. I think it's 8B1 or 8B2.
But the agreement itself would be an AD agreement.
Yes, the agreement might be an AD agreement, as it was charged to be in the container cases. There's no question that in resolving these preliminary questions of whether or not there should be a labor exemption, and the illustration I've given shows the subtlety of the kind of labor relations decision has to be made, the Maritime Commission is undertaking to do the job that Congress has said should be done by the Labor Board. To support the contention that there is a unique situation in the West Coast which doesn't apply to which Pennington and Connell do not apply is the solicitor's concession on pages 6 and 7 of his reply brief, extremely important from the union's point of view. In view of the existing institutions on the West Coast, and they are unique and special institutions there, as has been indicated and as the brief established, for the employment of longshoremen, some agreement on the access of non-members to the joint PMA programs, the joint PMA-ILW programs and facilities is necessary. This is a jointly controlled workforce. The union cannot say to the non-members, you can have the workforce. It has got It has got to have PMA's consent because it's a joint workforce. It's not a union-controlled workforce, and the solicitor recognizes that, therefore, some agreement is necessary. Again, he argues that this agreement is entitled to a labor exemption because it's outside the bargaining unit. For the reasons I've indicated, we have a very unique situation with respect to what is the bargaining unit here, and that is a question that the Labor Board needs, rather than the Federal Maritime Commission, needs to determine. So it is our submission that where the employees involved are common to both sets of employers, you don't have a Pennington situation, you don't have a Connell situation, where the union represents all of the employees, and in Pennington they did not, and in Connell's was pointed out in Mr. Justice Powell's opinion, the union not only didn't represent the employees in that case, it wasn't even seeking to represent them. Here it represents the employees of both sets of employers. Well, you've got a situation like this, you've got a special kind of a unique labor situation, and the commission was just, the Federal Maritime Commission was, with respect, naive and unsophisticated to say what the Labor Board might have done or would have done under these circumstances and in attempting to apply this court and the Labor Board's criteria in its so-called distillation of this court's decisions. Furthermore, the union was faced, as the solicitor concedes, in these very negotiations with a proposition that PMA had the right to insist on equality of treatment on the Most Favored Nations Clause. And if the union had given the non-members anything better than it gave PMA, PMA would have said, give it to us too, and the union would have been whipsawed between two sets of employers. I see my time's up.
Finish your sentence.
The union and the association negotiated in the best interest to solve a very difficult labor problem. I believe they are entitled to the labor exemption. For the reasons stated in our briefs, we think the Maritime Commission did not have jurisdiction. I don't have time to expound upon that, but I'll have to submit
if you prevail, I take it the antitrust cases, if there are some pending, will just go forward.
Presumably they
and,
will.
Or some others will be filed, and you will have this antitrust issue decided in the courts. And it's very likely that no part of the issue will get before the board, the labor board.
If the ports don't choose to file labor board charges. And the question there is, what is the proper form for the resolution of these issues, the courts or the Federal Maritime Commission? Thank you.
You have about 2 minutes left, Mr. Friedman.
First, just a preliminary matter in response to Mr. Justice Stewart's question as to what actually happens if the board grants a labor exemption. I understand if that takes place, the commission would enter a declaratory order to the effect that the agreement need not be filed and then dismiss the proceeding. But let me get to what seems to me, is, as the argument has developed, kind of the guts of this case, which is whether this is the sort of an agreement that is not properly before the Maritime Commission at all. The suggestion that Mr. Leonard has made is somehow this is a matter to be decided by the National Labor Relations Board. Well, Mr. Justice White, in your concurring opinion, your opinion in Jewel T, you pointed out that the Labor Board is not really equipped to handle these things. There's no way you can get a decision out of the Labor Board. All you can do is file a charge. And if the General Counsel decides not to issue a complaint on the charge, that's the end of it. But more significantly than that, this Court has recognized on not a few occasions, most recently in the Burlington case, that situations may arise where cases present issues involving different agencies. In the Burlington case, there were problems under the Labor Act and there were problems under the Interstate Commerce Act. And this Court said the Interstate Commerce Commission properly considered the problems under its statute, and if something were filed with the Labor Board would consider it. Now, the claim is that, an argument here with respect to the bargaining unit. Well, the bargaining unit that was originally certified by the Labor Board, of course, was the employers on the West Coast who were members of the predecessor associations. If somebody thinks that this bargaining unit should now be broadened to include The non-members, so they can file something before the Labor Board, but it seems to us that the Commission was properly and fully justified in accepting the case as it existed. That is, as of now, what you have is a bargaining unit consisting of these employees, some of whom work for PMA members, most of them who do, some of them occasionally do not, and the PMA members. And when you attempt to impose, when the union and the employers get together and attempt to impose conditions on people who are not members, those are people outside the bargaining unit. And we just don't think
we understand that, but you also say that whatever antitrust issue there is here should be first decided by the Maritime Commission.
By the Maritime Commission. That is the
Even though the antitrust division may be wholly foreclosed.
That we think is the scheme Congress has provided under this statute, that not only is there an antitrust exemption, but this Court recognized in the C-Train case that in interpreting the statute whether an agreement is in the public interest, the Commission is required to consider the antitrust implications of that agreement.
Mr. Friedman, just one question before you sit down. Mr. Fisher, I think it was, stressed the pre-implementation approval requirement. And the statute, as I recall, has an exception for rate agreements which may receive interim approval. Is there a statutory authority for interim approval of an agreement of this kind?
There's no explicit statutory authority, but we've described in our brief and in our reply brief and also cited one instance in our main brief, the Commission on occasion has granted this so-called conditional or interim approval to provisions that are included in collective bargaining agreements. They have done this on a couple of occasions.
What's the status? I just remember about the agreement in question here, about the provision of the agreement in question here.
That has not been implemented. The parties have kept it in abeyance pending the outcome of this decision, as is true with the administrative proceedings before the Commission.
Very well, Mr. Friedman. Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.